first.
This is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with
Ryan Gow.
Recorded on March 1st at the Bay Street Armory, interviewed by Courtney Yanta. Do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes.
So, when did you first enlist?
I enlisted in 1998.
Okay, and why did you enlist?
Actually, it was a bet with my dad. We drove past the armory in Nanaimo, and the old base used to work there. So what he did is we saw a recruiting sign, and one thing led to another, and he bet me I couldn't survive basic training. And I played junior hockey, so I was always up for a challenge. So I bet him I would. So I ended up going to Wainwright, Alberta that summer and passing and enjoyed it. So I decided to continue on.
That's good. What was your military service prior to going to Bosnia?
I didn't have a lot of service. I served over in Shiloh as a gunner. So
where's Shiloh, sorry?
Shiloh, Manitoba.
Okay.
It's one of the gunnery schools we go to. So after I finished basic training in Wainwright, Alberta, I came back, completed my gunnery course in Victoria, BC, and then got a tasking with the battery over in Shiloh, Manitoba. And I spent some time there perfecting my gunnery and doing other courses and everything else. And then after I got back, I finished a communications course. And then I basically went overseas almost.
Straight to Bosnia then?
No, actually we spent another, 4 or 5 months almost on pre-training. And on that pre-training, we did old patrol procedures, old section attacks, and things that prepare us as well as peacekeeping duties and on how to patrol and how to do presence patrol, as well as how to like aid to civil power and stuff like that, like setting up a concertina wire line and having like cut off men and stuff like that. So you have to, the training is designed to be harder than what the actual task is, so that when you get over there, it's not as bad. So we had a pretty good ramp up. We had to deal with riots during training. We had people and actors come in and act as riots and then rioters, and we'd have to deal with them. We'd have to basically qualify on all our weapon systems. So me as an artilleryman, I'd qualify on the 105 millimeter howitzer, and we use the LG-1, which is just a pack howitzer. It's a French gun that we can use because it's a helicopter mobile, and it's a little bit lighter than the C3s that we have down on the armory floor, so a little bit more versatile overseas. And then we would do, we also have to do our fitness component as well, because you have to be in shape before you go overseas, because you don't want to have anything happen over there and not be in shape to do it. But that's basically what I went into after I got back.
So you talked about the training. What information were you given before your deployment in regards to the situation in Bosnia?
Information we were given. We were given a brief political overview of what was happening between the Serbs, the Bosnian, and the Croats, and what the situation was. It was basically deteriorating between, like, former Yugoslavia for a reason. So basically we were told that these three entities were basically clumped together, not by their own will, and that these hostilities were basically came out of that particular, like, political situation where none of them wanted to live together, and they are forced in that. And each religious group just didn't really get along and fit in the right piece with the others. So what it ended up starting was a civil conflict, and the Serbs had the upper hand because a lot of them had all the military power, and the Bosnians and the Croats, again, it's basically a triad of just people not liking each other. So that was a major part of the information that we got when I went over.
Did you get any of your, like, you had gone to Bosnia 2000, 2001, you said?
Yeah.
So the conflict had been going on for almost a decade.
So by the time I got over there, the conflict had, like, the major part of the conflict had already run its course. And we were on the tail end of this. So for us, it was more or less maintaining the peace than it was having to make the peace. So every month we'd actually take our guns out of storage, and we'd actually bring in the local commanders for the communities, and we'd literally shoot in front of them to show, okay guys, you don't play nice, then we revert back to this and we'll make you guys play nice. So by doing a show of force, we show that we're not just there as peacekeepers, but we do have the capabilities to basically enforce the peace if it needed to be. And that was just a reminder to them that we could do it. It also helps us confirm our skills once a month as well, because you get a little bit of skill fade if you're just doing certain things. And for an artilleryman, we still have to be our role, but we're infantry as well.
Did you see, like, when you were doing those practices, did you see a lot of the violence kind of starting to come to the surface again?
No, that's fairly civil. Like, we'd have a few, the first week I was in Bosnia, we had a threat of a civil demonstration through our base, and I was stationed in Tomislavgrad, or TSG as we called it, and basically nothing really materialized in my area. I got thrown up in a tower with a machine gun. I got all excited for nothing and just kind of looked, and cars would go by. And I think that the tension was, it was still there, it was still underlying, but it wasn't as visible as it was early in the 90s when a lot of things were going on. And a lot of the tours prior to mine would deal with a lot worse. And those were the guys that were seeing the graves and stuff. I didn't really have any experience with that particular part. By the time I went over there, it wasn't peacemaking, it was peacekeeping. So
did you get any other, like, were you following the conflict on the news or before you went, thinking you might be deployed there?
Actually, as a reservist, because I was reserve, and I still am, but as a reservist, we volunteer. So a certain amount of spots will be allocated for the reserves to fill. And within my organization, the 5th Field Regiment here, they said, well, who wants to go? And it's a bit of a competition to get your name in the slot to go. So you have a lot of things to prove. And then you have your employers and everything to deal with on the sidelines. But at the time, I asked my parents, I asked my family, and I said, well, look, hockey's not really going anywhere for me. I'm not having fun anymore, but I have this coming up and I feel like that I could do something with this. So I put my name in the hat with the best intention that hopefully I get on, and I happened to get on with a few of my other friends. And from there, we basically did our basically pre-deployment DAG, which is just basically get your medical updated, your shots updated, and just make sure you're really good to go. Then you get sent off to a reg force unit. I worked with the 1st Royal Canadian Horse Artillery, and I worked with B Battery, so I got posted to a gun, and then I started my workup training, started getting involved with the group.
How did you find the transition going from the reserves to the regular army?
It wasn't bad. For a reservist, initially there's a little bit of, this guy's just a part-time guy, and the attitude was there a little bit, but by the time we got ramped up into training, they realized I wasn't just there to kind of be that guy on the sidelines. I wanted to get involved in anything or everything, basically. And even the guys that came with me, I think the attitude shifted a little bit towards us for the fact that they knew that we weren't just there to just kind of be there this wasn't just for fun. This was actually, we were serious about being over there. So for us, it was like, well, I want to do something, and I want to do something with the Army, and this might lead into full-time. Like, I had an offer for Reg Force after I got back home. I didn't take it, but I had the opportunity to, but I got to do my job full-time, which was actually pretty exciting.
So, kind of going off of that, How were you treated when you returned then?
I was treated pretty well. Upon return, we have to do kind of like a debrief. To see how we handled the stress of being overseas and how our tour went for us and any personal challenges and stuff. We had the opportunity to talk to the Padre, and we also talked to the chain of command, and we got even help back here in Victoria. Like, we have a pretty good friend system in here, so if there's problems, we try to look out for one another. So I felt I was well managed from the time I got back to Canada and to the time, even to this day, I feel that I was actually pretty well supported, and I feel even now that if I had the opportunity to talk to someone, there's someone available.
Can you take me through a typical day for you on your deployment in Bosnia?
Bosnia, for me, I was a gunner, and I was also a machine gunner and a communicator. So our days were 12 hours long. The big thing was is you would do a combination of gate guard, and you'd also do dismounted patrols. So depending on where we were, because I was located in TSG in Tomislavgrad for the first half of my tour, then from there my battery got moved to Glamok, which is about 2 and a bit hours away in the Livno Valley, and we got to live in an old bombed out sawmill, which was a lot of fun. And in TSG, a lot of ours was, there's a lot of gate guard involved, so you'd be checking vehicles and personnel that are coming and leaving the camp. And you do that for typically six hours, give or take. And then you do another 6 hours of patrolling, depending on what part of the debt you are with. For me, TSG was pretty nice because you had a nice gym area, we had a nice hockey rink. So we had amenities, so you're trapped on a base, but it wasn't so bad. In Glamok, you were your own, like, the only people you had to rely on was your own battery. So I was with, when I was with B Battery, when we were putting in Glamok, what would happen, or I was with Delta Troop, actually, and we're in Glamok, we only had our troop to rely on to do all the gate guards, all the patrolling, and all the duties. So you're doing your 12 hours, you're really doing your 12 hours because you don't have the opportunity to spell off as much. So we do a mounted patrol in an armored vehicle, and then we do a dismounted patrol, but we'd still have our guys on gate guard as well. So we'd be really stretched out on how we do it. So we typically get 2.5 days on, 1.5 days off to keep the rotation going. So 12 on, 12 off, and switching out between the other guns. So it wasn't bad. You got to see a lot of the countryside. My main patrol route took me through Livno Valley, through Glamok, and also through TSG. So we got to actually go up the side of the mountain and go into the backcountry where most vehicles aren't going to go a lot. And we got to see all the remote communities and remote villages. So a lot of what we did, we actually delivered humanitarian aid. We delivered firewood, and we delivered whatever we could. There was actually a cheese factory on our patrol route, so we actually got an opportunity to help this guy get his business off the ground and get it back going again. And he took us through his factory and showed us everything, which was actually really awesome. So I don't think we would have had that opportunity for most other routes. Like with us, it was a lot of we'd see a lot of kids. So both my parents are school teachers, so a lot of the guys, while we're on tour, we always try to see what we can do. My parents sent, my mom's school, they got together a little collection, and they ended up sending about 5 or 6 boxes of aid with toys and crayons and stuff like that for the kids. And we end up kind of pulling that together, and we would help distribute it throughout our patrol. And even then, we also had all the NATO countries and everything else. They'd have their own kind of aid stuff, like shoes, jackets, and everything else. Because some of these communities you're going into literally had the community, and that's it. And they wouldn't have anything. And they would segregate themselves. So you'd have a Muslim quarter, then you'd have a Kurat quarter, and then you have this. And they literally didn't want to talk to one another whatsoever. So with that, we just kind of were like, okay, this is kind of, especially being Canadian, you're used to being able to talk to everybody. But now you're like, well, that guy is Croat, I can't talk to him, and I can't hire him, and I can't do this. And we actually had, I was working gate guard in Glamok, and I had an older lady come to the gate. And unfortunately, my Bosnian isn't that great, so you always have to wait 5 minutes for a translator to come. And we give them this little language card. So once they're done talking to you, because you say Dobar dan, kako ste, which is, hey, how are you? You would just kind of sit there, and they'd start talking to you like you know how to speak the language, and you're like, oh. So you'd stand there politely and just kind of be quiet, and then you give them the card that says, I speak no Bosnian whatsoever. If you could wait 2 minutes, we'll get the translator. So then they'd have to say it all over again. But the translator usually came out, and most of the time I'd meet people that are looking for jobs. And we had the Brit camp was just up the street from us, so it wasn't too far away. But we had one lady come in and tell us her story, which was, the Croats won't hire me because my husband is Bosnian. The Bosnians won't hire me because I'm Croat. The Serbs won't hire me because I'm Croat. And we're just like, and it was crazy. I just couldn't, it's kind of hard to get around that kind of fact. Like, And fortunately for some of these people, that, like, especially the ones that are a little bit more proactive and think that the conflict isn't as bad, and they do intermarry sometimes, but the stress it puts on their family is huge. And sometimes the bases are the only place they can really get that kind of employment, depending on how good they are. And we try to hire local where we can, like the cleaners and a lot of the cooks, and they come in and there's tests that Canada would do with them, and we have standards that they have to meet in order to be employed. But we do our best to employ the community, so it shows them that we're kind of vested in the area, and it also kind of says, okay, well, we can support these guys because they're actually employing us and paying us to be here, so it isn't so bad. And every once in a while, they'll let the Bosnian chefs or the local chefs kind of have their local cuisine night, which is always kind of an interesting thing. But it was I would say I had a pretty good experience with being over there while I was there anyway.
When you're working with these, you know, they're segregated, you're saying,
yeah,
right? Were they hostile towards the troops or anything for, you know, being kind of a linchpin?
It's not really. A few times we had we had a drunk guy throw a chair at a courier and kick a driver in the head once. Like, I think a couple of the guys got more of a chuckle out of it because the fact the guy made it up on top of the carrier, managed to do that, he was pretty wasted. So wasn't my patrol, so I don't know the whole story. But for the most part, it would just be how you talk to them and how much information they want to share. Whether, like, it's sometimes, like, you'd be in there, you're there for 6 to 7 months. So if they see you enough, you kind of build a rapport with the people of those areas, and especially if they have something to offer, because a lot of these people have literally nothing. And we help people get beds, and if we're seen as somebody that can actually get them something, then they're not so bad about coming up and telling us certain things. But you really have to kind of work your way into that, because how often a rota will come out, and there's a new guy at the helm. So they have to rebuild the trust that they had with the last guy. Or if the last guy treated them very, like, poorly, then all of a sudden, well, why should I talk to you? I didn't get anything from the last guy, and what do you have to offer now? It's a fresh face, and sometimes that's good. Sometimes it's bad having that changeover, but it really depends. We do have a lot of people that come up to us willingly, no problem, and usually they'd be asking, oh, do you have anything for me, or can you help me with this, and can we do that? And as much as we would try to help, we'd take these requests in, and we'd say, well, we'll do what we can, but we can't promise anything, because we're not in that we're not in the kind of area to promise a lot. So, but we'll do what we can do. And handing out aid, that can be a dangerous thing in itself, because when we're handing out aid in this one village, the village, it's almost like every man for himself in some cases when you're dealing with aid, because it depends on what you're doing. Like, we had to go to this one village who didn't really have a lot. And we started handing out jackets and coats and stuff, and one old lady was trying on a coat, and this guy just ripped it off her and, like, ran for the hills. So it's almost like their sense of community wasn't always there. Like, there's some communities we went into, then, and these guys are way in the mountains, so for them getting back and forth and to, like, normal shops and everything else is kind of hard, and even challenging in most cases, because there's minefields all over Bosnia, and that was one of the biggest things they had to worry about. But with these people being so far out of the beaten trail and aid and stuff.
So earlier you're talking about the amenities on the base, the hockey rink, etc. So did you have a lot of time to do that? I know you really like hockey, so was that?
For us, actually, we got a lot of opportunity to, well, PT was any, like, physical fitness training was any time you're off. So that 12 hours that you have off, you kind of did whatever you wanted to do. So as long as it stayed on base, for me, and that includes your sleep time, for me, I go play hockey, pick up hockey when I could, or I have my gym buddy and we go to the gym. And the gym facilities in TSG were awesome, and I couldn't complain because they had lots of time in the gym, lots of good equipment. And going out at the hockey rink that we built, that was a great time, unless you lost all your balls in the minefield. But we'd get some like good games going and stuff, and then the game would get to its pitch, and then the ball would go over the fence, and of course goes into minefield, and everyone's trying to figure out, okay, what do we do now? So there was quite a rapid ball supply since we keep losing them. But it was actually a well-built facility. It was a paved hockey court, boards. We used netting for the glass, and actually it was quite well done. We'd have tournaments there all the time. We actually, for a week on my tour, actually got to play for the base hockey team for floor hockey. And we went and traveled to Vanja Luka. And they had a big tournament there where we had all the bases kind of put all their guys in, and we had a base tournament. So that was actually a week of hockey that I got to play in a different country. So it had its perks. So if you played hockey, there was a little bit of more opportunity to do stuff, but it meant the boys were taking your gate guards and your patrols and stuff like that. So you had to treat them good.
So you're saying the base would offer would employ locals.
Yeah.
Would this be something that they could partake in, like hockey games or anything?
No,
like that?
No, this was for the troops.
Yeah.
A lot of it goes down to liabilities. One of my buddies overseas broke his leg on playing broomball. So we can't be hurt in civvies, and army games, guys get competitive, and sometimes it goes a little bit far, but it's still good fun. Like for broomball tournaments, broomball is probably one of the roughest sports I've ever seen, and we got lucky because we got to play hockey. In Inglemock, we didn't have a hockey rink, but we built one because this bombed out sawmill had three parts to it. So in the back half of the sawmill, like there's still a roof on it, so it wasn't too bad. But it was basically just a large open warehouse space. So what we did is we brought in some modular trailers, and we built our accommodation tents in there. And we also had a little internet room, so we can at least get some, like we didn't have Facebook at the time. We just like Yahoo chat the wife and say everything's good. And then we'd have some phones in there as well. So you get 50 minutes on the phone every so often. So at least you can, it kind of breaks up being stuck in a little camp because in Glamok, the camp was actually really small, so you really couldn't go out. The only way you got to go out is if you're going on patrol or you're going on a tasking or going on leave, but everything else was in the side of the camp. So you really had to kind of figure out what to do. And there's only so much you can kind of do. So what we did is we took some time and we went and built a hockey rink, and we actually had a little tournament for ourselves within the battery. And we have a St. Barbara's Day, which is the patron saint of the Gunners, and we'd always have a hockey tournament for that. So we'd bring the little battery in and do a tournament. So there's always something for us to do. We actually also built a boxing ring in Glamok, and unfortunately it got shut down. It was actually quite the spectacle. We'd have the Americans and the Brits would come and watch us box each other, and then the leadership was like, well, probably not a good idea with concussions and everything else coming. And there'd be a couple of split lips here and there, and like, oh, okay, so that fun's gone. But we'd always try to find something to do, and we'd have we had a workout room in there, not as nice as TSG, but still pretty adequate for how many people were using it. And we had a nice little relaxation room, so we had a TV, and we'd basically have our own little space. So it wasn't horrible, and you can always kind of figure out what to do. And if they're nothing to do with those, you just kind of chillax and read and do whatever you could.
Was there a lot of intermingling between troops, like Canadian troops and troops from, you're saying, Britain and stuff like
that? Yeah, we got the opportunity to do a cross exchange with the Brits. So I went and worked on their larger, like their AS-90s, which is a self-propelled howitzer. It's like a tank with a giant gun on it. And they sent some of their guys to us, and they got to work with us as well. So while we're there, we got to go and actually do our job with them. So their guns were actually phenomenal. So they would, they're just give you perspective, our guns would fire a 33-pound round. Their guns fire a 100-pound round. And they can fire three of those 100-pound rounds in about 9 seconds. And they showed us how they were able to do it with basically just fire at a high angle, so the barrel's almost like pretty high up, and then it'll drop and then fire again and drop, and all three of those rounds will hit the target at the exact same time.
Wow.
And we got to do some of the, it was actually amazing. And it's kind of fun to see what the other side of the coin does. I actually made the unfortunate mistake of changing out rations with them. So it's always fun. So I'm sitting on the side of the carrier, and one of the Brit soldiers comes like, "Hey, is a bombardier." So a bombardier for them is like a master bombardier for us. And he's like, "Hey, you guys want to switch rations?" I'm young, so I'm like, "Okay, well, I'm adventurous." Sure. So I pass over my IMP, and we have like chocolate bars, and it wasn't bad. Like we had pretty good rats. So I'm like, "Okay, what do you guys eat?" So he brings out this burlap sack, and I'm like, "Oh, you got to be kidding." And this thing, a tin of meat paste, and I'm like, "Whoa, did I get the short end of the stick on this one?" So I'm like, "Okay, I'm trying to be nice." So I tried it. It wasn't the nicest I've ever had, but it was definitely an experience. And just the way they administer their discipline was crazy. So I was on their gun, and we're firing, and one of their new brand new gunners, like brand new guy, he's newer than I was. He's on the number three side on the sights, and with a 155 millimeter gun, you don't have a casing like a 105 does to put charge bags in, so it launches the projectile. They have charge bags, so you put the projectile in, and it's rammed in there with the actual a rammer, which is a mechanical mechanism, just pushes around into the tube. And then you have to load bags in behind it, which will give it its charge. So that's the propellant that launches it out of the barrel. And with one of those, you need something to ignite the charge. So it's a primer casing that it's actually a cartridge, kind of like a shotgun, and it's brass. So after they fired the round, and the number one, who is the staff sergeant, is like, "Come here." And he took this brass primer casing, just fired, and he's rammed it on the end of his nose and split his nose up. I'm like, "What the hell is going on here?" I'm not sure if it's a little bit of showboating, but I'm just... It was definitely a different world compared to how Canadian forces treat their soldiers. Like, you'd never get away with that as a sergeant or master on a Canadian gun. There's a fair bit of yelling and swearing sometimes, because you have to be on time, on target, and you always have that push to get things moving. But there's no physical altercations like that between a sergeant and a young gunner, unless something's completely seriously gone off the rails, and even then you got to have those guys throughout your time there, because you don't have the opportunity to bring in somebody else if someone gets broken. So you're going to counsel them, you're going to do every thing, but it's not going to be a punch him in the face and hopefully he learns. It's going to be a, "Hey, what the hell, what are you doing?" And if you walk around the carrier kind of shaking my head going, "What the hell?" And there's two guys doing push-ups getting kicked into the ribs because they put mud in their staff sergeant's coffee. And I'm like, "I thought I walked into the Twilight Zone." So I'm not sure if, again, me and the boys are like, "I wonder if they're showboating a little bit." But it didn't look like it to me. That guy looked pretty genuinely pissed off. But it was definitely one of those things you're kind of like looking at what the Canadian Armed Forces is. And then we worked a little bit with the Germans as well. And we had the... Czech Republic, they gave us rides in their helicopters. Those were kind of crazy, because apparently these things were known to follow the sky. And we were actually moving artillery pieces with them. So we decided that we needed to be helicopter mobile. And because our guns were that, these are like a pack howitzer, we said, "Well, let's do a helicopter exercise." So we took one of their helicopters and put one of our guns on it, and it flew from our position to another position to set up. And this is part of our training as well. So we're getting in there. I don't fly very well as it is. And we had to stick tree branches in the back of the guns because the guns were spinning too much. So this was supposed to act like a rudder. Really didn't do anything. It just caught the wind a little bit more. Yeah, I guess it straightened it out a little bit, but I didn't find it that much of a difference. So this, you'd be sitting in the helicopter with all your kit and everything, and then the helicopter starts speeding up, and you're looking at this big hole in the middle of the helicopter with a rope in it. And you can see the gun down at the bottom dragging on, kind of twirling on a string. So the gun would swing forward, the helicopter would speed up, and the gun would swing back, the helicopter would slow down, and you're like, "Oh my God, just get me on the ground." So, like, experience-wise, it was still cool, but I think I was a one-off, and I'm pretty good with just staying on the ground. But still a lot of fun.
Yeah. Okay, jumping back to... your tasks and such.
Yeah.
You said you're a communicator.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Tell me a little bit more about
that. So what I was in charge of is I was the primary communicator for my troop, or for my gun. So I was responsible for doing the radio checks as we left on patrol. I'd carry the radio, so basically that thing was my baby throughout the entire tour. So if anything went wrong with it, they're like, oh wait, what's going on? And I would have to maintain the radio, not only the man pack, which is the mobile carry one, but I'd do the vehicle radio as well. So I'd be working on that, making sure that we always had comms, and if we didn't have comms, I'd be figuring out why. So we got a lot of opportunity to go through and do regular maintenance and stuff. So, and communications when you're in the mountains and when you're out on patrol is paramount. If you don't have communications and something goes sideways, then you're basically stuck on your own. So for me, that was my primary job. Secondary job was a machine gunner. So I'd be in charge of helping put together the 50 caliber machine gun and the C6, which is a 7.62 millimeter machine gun. And again, we'd qualify in those every month. We try to do a shoot, so we'd still stay current in case, well, the worst happens. But typically, it wasn't that bad while I was over there. But communications was a big part of my job, just making sure the radios were up and running. And when I was on leave, I had a backup communicator that would take over for me. And usually, they're happy to see me get back because they're like, oh, I don't have to do this anymore. But communications was huge.
You said in your form too that you worked patrolling minefields.
Yes.
So can you tell me about that?
Well, in my area there was lots of minefields. So literally mines as far as you can see. And in Livno Valley, you'd actually drive down the mountain and you would see like pots and pans covering the entire field. And they did that. The Bosnians and the locals would do that in order to ensure that the cattle didn't step on the mines. So if you saw pots and pans like littered on a field, don't go pick any of them up, because every one of those pot or pan or whatever they had to cover it, that would generally be covering a landmine or a suspected landmine. So and I found this out when we're going down Livno Valley for the first time, and I'm looking in the field, I'm like, what the hell is all the pots and pans for? And I'm like, aren't these people to ever cook or something? And they're like, no, those are actually landmines. I'm like, you kidding me? And we're watching out, and these cows, and I guess the livestock eventually kind of figured out where good places to go and where not to go. And we almost, this cow went up, almost like touched in one of those like landmines, because we're looking out in the field and we're like, oh my God, we're gonna see cow bits any minute. And it was hatches down, and we're kind of looking out, we're like, oof, this is gonna be crazy. And of course it backed off, because I think it kind of knew what was going on. But for me, walking on the grass when I got back home was crazy, because you spent so much time overseas saying, don't walk on the grass, don't go off the hard pack, don't do this, don't do that. And then you get back in the country and all of a sudden it's safe to walk on the grass again. You've trained yourself not to, because it may look fun and you're like, okay, that's a nice field. Yeah, I'm not gonna go walk there today. So anytime we went off the hard pack, we'd have the engineers go in and clear it. Even our gun positions, we'd have somebody go ahead and make sure that it's actually safe to occupy. So anytime we had to leave the beaten path, which would be a hard pack road, or even a hard pack dirt road, we would make sure that it's clear. Like we'd gun positions, we'd actually be fairly tight, because we don't have much time and many resources to clear the space we need for all of our guns to get a good position, because we'd want our guns to be spaced out about 25 to 50 meters apart. And some of our gun positions were literally firing over each other because they were so tight. But mine awareness was something we did monthly, because you get complacent and then the worst happens. And it only takes once. So one of my patrols, we actually came across a Bosnian, I'm suspecting he's Bosnian, I didn't ask the translator. So we come across this truck that's parked right in the middle, and with a 10-ton carrier, we aren't going anywhere. So, and it's the roads on the side of the mountain, they're one vehicle roads, you don't get any through, and our thing is we don't leave the hard pack for any reason whatsoever. So we're not pulling off to the side of the road and letting this guy through, he's gonna let us through. So we're kind of sitting there waiting, and then all of a sudden we notice, we're like, all right, there's two guys off the side of the cliff going, kind of looking at something. We're like, okay, so we dismount and we go over and we find out what they're looking at. And our translator and our number one is talking to this guy, and I'm standing by the side of the cliff, and this guy just happened to be throwing rocks pretty much where I was. And I'm like, okay, what the hell is going on here? Did I do something bad? And I'm kind of looking around where the rocks are landing, and there's a landmine about three feet away from me, just down the hill. And I'm like, oh, great. So I lose it. I'm not happy. I managed to keep it under wraps. I go behind the carrier and just start getting mad. And I just told the translator, like, you tell that guy to stop throwing rocks right now. So he goes back over, and our number one, our IC, his Master Bomber Lynch at the time, he kind of just like, holy crap. So he goes over and he's trying to mark this thing, and this guy just doesn't understand the concept of don't mess with this stuff. Because once you're in war for so long, and once you're in conflict for so long, and you see this stuff and it becomes a regular part of your day, the danger factor doesn't seem to be quite there anymore. Like, we had people that just didn't understand. Like, we said, just leave it in place, let us deal with it, don't touch it, don't do nothing to it, and just call us and tell us where it is. So we finally marked this thing, and we got these guys to get out of the way, and then by the time we reported it up, the engineers came, and they actually blew it up in place, didn't want to mess with it, because like there was a fire on that side of the mountain. We thought all the mines have already gone up in the fire and stuff, but apparently this one survived. No tripwire, no nothing. A shadow could have set it off. Anything could have set it off if you're messing around with it too much. And it was a PMR 2A. So if you ever get a chance to look at one of those, it looks like kind of like a pineapple with a bit of a stick out of it. And you can do it. Tripwire is usually one of the more fun starts to get it off. But when we saw it, I took a picture of it. I actually wish I brought the picture with me, but yeah, it was just sitting there, and no one noticed it until this guy was throwing rocks at it. I guess this is what they pulled over for, and they're showing us where these landmines are, and there's something else that we had suspected was something else down the ravine a little bit. There was actually a blown up tank just not too far away from it, and that was something that was also charred in the forest fire, and actually was put there after the war. So You got to see a lot of crazy stuff.
So you've talked about a lot of interaction with local civilians.
Yeah.
I know at this point the conflict is pretty much subdued, but what about the local forces? Any interaction with them?
We did. Are you talking about local law enforcement or the? We did have certain interactions with some of the Serbs would actually guard the ammunition depots in the area. So part of our job was also to make sure that they kept manning them. At one point while I was over there, the Serb government decided they weren't going to pay any of their soldiers. So we got wind of it, and all of a sudden it's like, okay, let's go see if those things are still manned, because there's a big threat that they're just going to walk off those ammunition depots and leave all that stuff unguarded. And we're just thinking, oh great, this is going to cause a lot of problems. Thankfully, that didn't happen. It was a false alarm, but our regular patrol routes actually took us through these areas just to make sure that we'd go up with our carrier in Glamoc anyway, and we'd go down the road to where the ammo depot is, and we'd, at all hours of the day, night, whatever, we'd always have to make sure there was someone in the gatehouse. And unfortunately, sometimes that meant waking some dude up. So we'd get the big spotlight, shine it in there until he got up, and then we'd drive away to make sure that there's someone still manned. Because one of our biggest fears was this ammunition depot being left unguarded and people just walking in and taking stuff that they shouldn't have, because that's stuff that we'd have to deal with. When we were in TSG, we actually went into Livno and confiscated over 300 weapons from their police. AK-47s, Uzis, and RPKs, and all these other items, and most of them were still in the original packing grease, and actually the police were glad to be rid of them. It just means we didn't have to go in there and inspect their facility or anything to make sure it was suitable to store all this stuff. And a lot of it was just remainder from the war, and we confiscated that and took it back and handed it over to someone else so that we didn't have to watch it anymore. So it definitely puts you in a different world. because you don't think about that kind of stuff when you're going over. You're like, okay, this is kind of a neat experience. And then you get into this and you're confiscating all these weapons, and then you're looking at landmines, you're looking at ammunition depots, and it's it definitely throws you into what actually happened over there.
Yeah. So were you given any guidance on what to do if they were left unattended? Like, did you know what your role was going to be? Like, what kind of action you'd have to take?
Generally, you're going to follow your rules of engagement. When you came across munitions that were, like, left out and no one's around, you don't touch it. You basically, you're going to guard it, and you're going to wait till an engineer group comes in there, because you don't know if it's booby-trapped. Anything that looks too good to be true generally is, and that's the attitude you have to have. Even if it's the thing you wanted most in the world, you leave it be until someone proves it safe. And when an engineer would go in there, and they'd have to clear houses, pump houses for water and stuff like that, because a civilian would report, well, there's something up with my pump house, or I see this in my pump house, and they would actually have to physically go and either take the pump house apart. And in one instance, when they found that a house was booby-trapped, they'd have to go in there and basically act like everything's dangerous, even the floor mats and everything else. And if there's weapons in that house, they tie a rope to the weapon, they walk outside, they pull, nothing happens, they go in there, they do it again, they continue to do that until the house is clear, because you can't trust anything. It doesn't take very much to hide an explosive device. It's actually fairly easy. And in Bosnia, there's almost every type of mine in the world. They had people that would stack anti-tank mines on top of each other, so that instead of the weight of a tank taking, crushing it to explode, it would take the weight of a person with full kit. So, and this is not just an anti-personnel mine. This is an anti-tank mine. So if you run over that, there's nothing left. And even in and this is why it was so much of a big deal. Like, you leave the hard pack for any reason, you better have a good reason to do it. We went into one village, and every few months you have to approve the route. And we wanted to go into this village, but we didn't have engineer support at the time, and we had to prove the route. Well, we knew the route was driven by other people before, but it hasn't been driven in a while, so you never know if someone could have gone and put something there. And again, this time in the conflict, there really wasn't a lot of hostility. So we basically went hatches up, and we all looked over, and we're like, all right, anyone see any of the ordinary? Just stop. So we drove into the village, and it let us gain access. And this is one of the places we actually end up dropping wood off to. We took a big HLVW, which is just a big, huge 10-ton. We dropped wood to this village because no one had been there for so long that they just kind of like, okay, well, we didn't know that you guys would come to us. So it was pretty good, and we got that community was a little bit better off than the community we dropped the other stuff off to. And we always had an opportunity to talk to the village elders and stuff like that, and kind of get an inkling of what the area was like. Most of the time they would invite us in, and we'd have like tea and coffee. And I'm telling the coffee there, if you think that espresso shots are horrible, these things are just little cups of coffee, and they'd have you humming for hours because it's just full of caffeine. Or they'd be brewing slivets in the backyard. It's moonshine for them. We'd just be driving along and just see a giant still in the backyard, because they really don't care. And every once in a while, we'd stop by and say, what are you guys doing? Oh, slivets. And once in a while, we might have a shot, but it would put you on your butt. So you just kind of do your own thing. Sorry.
So it sounds like civilians are pretty receptive to the Canadian presence in the region, or the international presence in the region. What about the local forces? I know that one instance you said they were happy to hand over the...
The police were. The local forces, it was hit and miss. With the people that occupied the ammo dumps, we didn't really have a lot of interactions with. And even with my own patrols, we didn't really interact with them much. The other troop had one instance where one of the armored regiments was driving past. Like, when we originally took Glamok, we were in a cement pad. We didn't have a sawmill or anything, and that was the other troop. So we had guys living for 3 months in nothing but tents, and they had all their bunks on basically just wooden racks and stuff like that to keep them out of the water, because it was that, like, the conditions for the other troop were not that good, because they get driven back to TSG once a week for a shower, and everything that they did was in a mess tent, so they didn't have any hard stand for them to actually relax in, and their footprint wasn't as nice as ours. And by the time they moved to TSG, they had established the base in Glamock and the sawmill, because they finally got that upgrade so they can actually be under something that was like a nice structure with like nice showers and stuff in there, and get a shower truck. But originally they were just on pallets and everything else, and it was pretty decrepit. But one of the armored regiments was moving through, and what we found out is the Serb, it was a mortar group, was across the road from us, that just there, and found out they're lazing, like basically getting coordinates to our command post. So the warrant went across the street and basically said, we found out you guys are lazing our command post. So we turned all our guns over to their direction and said, don't laser our command post again. And the next day they're gone. But they'll try to kind of put you off a little bit. And all he had to do is tell them to stop and basically show them that we weren't screwing around. And they would push you, and then they would kind of back off just to see what you would do. So they want to see what type of people they're dealing with. And it was interesting. Like, I wasn't part of that particular incident, but I never personally had any problems with many of the people I interacted with. And I rarely ever, because I was only a gunner, so I was a private trained, so I never really had to worry about the big interactions. It was mostly the leadership that had to deal with that stuff. I just had to worry that everyone in my area was secure and my radio worked, and basically keep an eye out for things. It was not too bad on that aspect.
So are there any memories that stand out for you most from your time in Bosnia?
One that really stood out was when I was patrolling in Glamock. We patrolled past a school, and we decided one day we're going to go in it. So when we went inside the school, there's a complete classroom full of kids. No teachers, none whatsoever. The kids would sit there, and when we came in, we were kind of looking around, and they just sat in their desks, like very, very respectful. And they were just waiting to see if someone would come and teach them that day. And it wasn't a guarantee. Sometimes a teacher would come, sometimes a teacher wouldn't come. And most of the time, the parents sent the kids to school just for something to do. And the kids would just sit in the class all day from the morning till the afternoon and manage themselves. And then if a teacher didn't show up, they'd go home. So that was, if you went to North America and no teacher was in the classroom, it would be like Lord of the Flies. And it just wouldn't work out. But it was amazing that these kids, well, they've been in war so long that school's a cool thing. It's crazy. Like, these kids were very good, and we went through that area more than a couple of times, but that was the first time we went in, and kids were just hands on top of their desk, and they're just looking and seeing what's going on. And it was definitely a humbling experience when you realize what kids go through in North America for education. And with my parents, it was like, oh, pulling teeth to get up for school in the morning. And these kids are there on their own accord in most cases, because they just want to see if there's something they can do.
Yeah.
And they want a further education. And then we ran a Christmas party, and this was another thing that kind of stood out to me. We ran a Christmas party in our base. So we brought in all the kids and all the families and stuff, and we had like a Santa and everything else. So we got to do something cool. And the kids would come in and they draw pictures. And every time they drew a picture of Santa, they would draw a picture of this red guy behind Santa with his hand in the sack. And we're like, what's this about? Well, Mom and Dad said that during the war, when Santa would put the toys out, the devil would take them away. So the parents, now this became part of the kids' drawings. And that was one of the other things that, like, just kind of blew my mind, going, wow, these kids have really came up with nothing. So when we managed to get stuff for them, we felt pretty good about giving it out. And having the Santa and everything in the base and doing that, it's a good community thing to do, and it's a good builder. So it shows the people that we're actually there and we care about what's going on. And it also definitely opens up your eyes on what kind of hardships these people went through during the real bad times. And it was pretty surreal, because you never even think about it, and then it happens and you're like, what the hell just happened? So for us, having that opportunity to see that other side of the coin, and I'm glad that none of my kids have gone through that. I'm glad my kids hopefully will never see that in their life, but to know that there's been children out there that have gone through that is just nuts.
That's crazy. Kind of going off of that then, and you earlier talking about, you know, coming back to Canada, you're walking on the grass, and that was such a a weird feeling, right? What other, like, little things like that from your time in Bosnia did you come back and were, it was such a...
Walking on the grass took me a little while to get used to again. Being able to go anywhere I wanted was another good thing, because you're stuck on a base for so long and you're like, you're used to being in that small little footprint with your gym, your hockey rink, and your mess, and your all these other places. And you get back to Canada, you're like, I can go to the bar, I can have more than two beer, because when we were overseas we had a punch card, so you couldn't drink more than two beer or else you get in trouble. So every time you go get a beer, your little punch card gets a punch. And how many beer do you have? How many punches in my card? So it was one of the things, that was a bit of a hard pill to swallow, having to be managed, but it was all right. There was a good reason for it, because you don't want guys being all wasted when they're on duty. But being able to do what you wanted to do when you're not on a base, you're like, well, now you have all these options. You don't even know what to do anymore, because you're so used to being in such a small footprint for so long that going out on the town, you're like, well, can I do that? Well, yeah, I guess I can. So it doesn't take much to get it readjusted, but I'm pretty sure that other tours, people from Afghanistan and people, a lot different attitude when you're on tour. Mine was, for the most part, I felt pretty relaxed. We had a few fun days there where it wasn't as fun. Parents never asked me how my day was after the landmine incident. My mom's just like, don't tell me that again. I'm like, okay. Because I was still fuming at that point, and I got to talk to my parents, like, how's your day? Well, almost got blown up. Doing pretty good. Pretty angry. And they're like, don't say that again, please. But other than that, is getting back to Canada, it's good to see your friends, your family, and getting reacquainted. And there's always, and you think how lucky you are to be where you are, because you're not restricted to how you move or what you walk on or where you go. Like, you can take a mountain trail and not worry about landmines being there or something happening. Like, it's nice in that aspect.
Just going off of that, yep. Were you able to contact your family a lot while you were in Bosnia?
Yeah, I snuck in a lot of calls to my wife, who's my girlfriend at the time, and my mom and dad. They had a pretty good clue of what I was doing and how I was doing. When I went overseas, my brother had passed away prior to my deployment in a car accident. So I had a bit of a rough go for mine. But, my thing was, my brother wouldn't want me to stop what I was doing, because something bad happened. And for me, it was, I had a lot of good friends overseas. So for some of my days, it was the peer system that got me through my tour a lot. Because if I had a bad day with thinking about my brother, that's the reason I liked work so much, is because I was thinking about everything else but that. So the battery was very, very accommodating. When my brother died in an accident, I was on workup training. I was in the middle of a field in Shiloh, Manitoba, and I found out. So the battery took me out of the field, got me on the first flight back to the island, and they said, well, you don't have to go on tour if you don't want to. And I'm like, no, I'm doing this. I did all this work, I did all this training, and my brother's not going to want me to stop just because something happened, because I would expect the same thing. So, and it was a definitely opportunity of a lifetime for me. And the experiences I gained out of that tour were, I wouldn't trade for anything. And I'd love to have, well, I traded for my brother back, but what I learned about myself and about the communities that other outside of Canada and opportunity to travel to Europe, it's kind of a thing that you want to do it.
Yeah. I'm so sorry about your loss.
Oh, it happens.
So what are your general feelings then about the Canadian service in Bosnia?
I thought we did a good job. I think that the people we met, I'd like to say that benefited from our presence there. The cheese factory was cool because the guy ran us through the entire factory, and we helped him get some resources together because he had basically nothing. And every roto kind of did help change the community for the better in a lot of ways. Just whether it be through the interpreters or employment of the local population. I'm hoping we made a really good difference, and I'm hoping that the people we ran into remembered the Canadians were there to help and everything else. So that was probably one of the better things from what I would take away from it. Because I like to help people, and I like to see people get back on their feet, and that was an opportunity to do that in some of the more extreme circumstances for us. Like going out of war to rebuilding is huge. So I wanted to help, and I felt I did.
That's great. I guess to finish up, is there anything that we didn't discuss that you wanted to share?
Not really. I think that I covered most of the experiences that I had while I was there. Like going on leave and traveling to different places was really cool. Like every soldier got the opportunity to go on an HLTA, which is a leave of sorts, where you get to leave your AOR, so your area of responsibility. And I got a couple of R&Rs too. So one I spent in Budapest, one I spent in Split, and then another one I spent in Ireland with. I had D&D flew my wife out. Well, she paid for her flight, but they would fly me pretty much anywhere I wanted to go. And because she was only my girlfriend at the time, didn't have the same benefits as being married, so it was a bit different. But I got to spend some time in other parts of the country and parts of the world that I never have a chance to see. So I felt that was just unreal. Like going to Split, Croatia, there was a lot of ancient Roman ruins. And have you been to Split?
I haven't.
Worth the trip. It's 2 hours from Rome too. So if you take a boat ride from Split, you'll go to Rome. The ferry only runs a few times, otherwise I went to Rome myself. But that was a great place. I got to meet fantastic people. And the translators, that they went through some hard times. And if I'm going to talk about anything, the translators, some of the guys that we met were just awesome people. Like, very sociable. But we had a few translators who really saw the ugly side of the war. And most of them had service with the Bosnian army that we used and employed. And one of the guys, I can't quite remember his name, but he told us about his regiment or his unit. They're fighting the Serbs, and they all speak the same language, and they're yelling, "I'm going to cut your head off," across trenches, and "I'm going to kill you while you're asleep." And the psychological game is, and a couple of these translators didn't quite make it out all the way there. Like, they're fun guys, they're awesome guys, and they teach you everything you want to know about language, but they saw a lot of weird stuff. One guy, he was in his regiment, and he's telling me about this one guy. He's just a big stocky Bosnian dude, and he's like, well, they were infantry, so he's like, "Yeah, I'm gonna run up that hill with my bare hands, I'm gonna kill those Serbs and do all this." And I'm just like, "Oh man, how do you deal with that?" And he's like, "Yeah, well, the guy got shot in the head by a sniper on the way up because they had to climb this mountain." And and a lot of these translators have just some of the craziest war stories, and you sit down and listen to them and you figure out what they've actually gone through. And we're fortunate to get the guys we had, because we had a lot of great times with our translators, and we treated them well and they treated us well, and they really did introduce and help lessen the blow to help get that rapport with the community and stuff like that. But some of the, I really have to respect what they've done and what they had to go through. And some of these guys are talking to Serb commanders and stuff. And they're still not on good terms. So for them to be able to sit there and talk to the guy that was their enemy not so long ago, it speaks to their character. So they went through a lot.
Yeah, that's great. Is there?
I can't really think of anything else unless you have any more questions.
I don't think I do. So I guess to wrap up, this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Sergeant Ryan Gout on March 1st, 2016. And we both signed the interview release form, is that correct? Perfect. Thank you so much for your participation. I really appreciate it.